Okay, welcome. My name is Divine. I'm a resident. This is episode 160 of the Divine Intervention Podcast. This podcast, I'm going to be continuing the rapid review series, but this is for the USMLE Step 1 exam. This is series 10. And this podcast, to be honest, is not going to have any particular like, oh, I'm focusing on GI or whatever. I want to try to integrate like multiple disciplines in this podcast. So it's going to be like a freestyle kind of podcast. So, what if they give you a question about a patient, and this patient, you know, they tell you that this patient was recently given, came in for surgery and got like a succinylcholine, and they notice during the course of the case, this patient is getting like super hyperthermic and has like diffuse muscle rigidity. What's your diagnosis? I would hope under those circumstances, you're thinking about something more along the lines of malignant hyperthermia, right? Remember, malignant hyperthermia, it arises classically. The classic presentation is a person will be exposed to like succinylcholine, or they'll be exposed to halothane, right? Like they inhale the anesthetics like halothane, and then they get like, you know, like this profound muscle rigidity and all that stuff. And they're typically hyperthermic, okay? They will try to confuse you on your exam and put neuroleptic malignant syndrome as an answer choice. Don't fall for that, because NMS, guess what? You need exposure to a neuroleptic to have neuroleptic malignant syndrome, right? So if a person, you know, recently started on like haloperidol or metoclopramide for like diabetic gastroparesis or anything like that, then yes, you can elect to do one of those things. And remember that malignant hyperthermia, right? It's actually inherited in an autosomal dominant fashion. It classically arises from mutations in the ryanodine receptor. That's the more common, so R-Y-A-N-O-D-I-N-E. So commonly arises from mutations like in the ryanodine receptor, occasionally, that's more common. And then in some situations, you may also see where people have like mutations in the dihydropyridine receptor. And really the way you treat malignant hyperthermia, right? You can give dantrolene. Remember, dantrolene is a calcium channel blocker. It's essentially a ryanodine receptor antagonist. So it prevents the release of calcium from the sarcoplasmic reticulum. And then, since I kind of talked about succinylcholine, you should also please not forget, right? Like succinylcholine, right? Remember, there are two types of, if you want to, you know, intubate someone, you know, you need to like paralyze, you need to, you know, knock them out first, and then you paralyze them with a muscle relaxant, like a neuromuscular blocking agent. So the thing is, the neuromuscular blocking agents, they fall into two categories, right? So, and I've talked about this ad nauseum in my neuropharmacology podcasts, they're one of like the earliest podcasts on this website. Just again, use the search feature on the website. You can find these podcasts pretty easily. And also, I also break things down like by tags. So I guess that's another thing you can do. But basically, right, the depolarizing neuromuscular blocking agents, right? Like the way I think about them is that they activate the nicotinic acetylcholine receptor, but then they keep it activated for long. At some point, the receptor just burns out. That's why typically people, when they get succinylcholine, they tend to have like fasciculations. I kind of talked about that again in the neuropharmacology podcast. And remember that succinylcholine, right, it's actually broken down by an enzyme known as a pseudocholinesterase, right? So it's broken down by pseudocholinesterase. So if a person, for example, right, has like decreased activity of pseudocholinesterase, then that can potentially cause an issue with them, you know, being weaned off that succinylcholine. That's another very high yield thing that commonly comes up on the USMLE exams. And then, what if they give you a question about a patient that has, like a guy that's like 6'5" tall, and this guy has been having marital problems because he's not able to have kids with his wife, and they tell you that on physical exam, this guy has gynecomastia, and this guy has like a tiny, like, you know, like a micro penis, very small testicles. What's your diagnosis? Well, I hope you're thinking about Klinefelter syndrome, right? So Klinefelter syndrome, classic presentation, right? Tall guy, infertility, poorly developed secondary sexual characteristics, gynecomastia, micro penis, micro testicles, right? That's the classic presentation on MBM exams. Now remember, these guys, you may actually want to strongly consider getting an orchiectomy at some point, because with their testes, they actually have a pretty high risk of getting a germ cell tumors. Another group with these like reproductive style issues where, you know, you need to do an orchiectomy sooner rather than later, are people that have androgen insensitivity syndrome. You need to get rid of those testicles they have, because that can very easily give rise to, like, again, like a gonadoblastoma. Same thing also kind of applies to patients with a history of Turner syndrome. And Klinefelter syndrome, really, the way you treat it, when those people get older, like in puberty or whatever, you can actually give them testosterone to sort of help them develop like secondary sexual characteristics as appropriate. And the reason this person has gynecomastia, the way I think about it is the body tries to, you know, maintain like a, I mean, it's like a testosterone to estrogen ratio in a sense. So whenever you have like something that like makes one hormone higher relative to the other, you will get like effects from that hormone, right? So if, for example, a person has Klinefelter's, right? Remember, Klinefelter is like 47XXY, and you make the diagnosis with a karyotyping, right? That's a pretty easy one there. Don't get that wrong on a test. But basically, the thing that happens is, you know, because their testicles don't really work as well, right? So they're not making enough testosterone. So they have a relative excess of estrogen, right? So that's why they have the gynecomastia. And then one next thing I want to talk about here is what if they give you a question about a person that is, you know, like an albino, right? And they ask for like the enzyme deficiency that's giving rise to that person's albinism. What do you think it is? Well, I would really, really hope you're thinking about tyrosine oxidase deficiency, right? Tyrosine oxidase deficiency. The thing is, for purposes of the USMLE exams, right, you definitely want to know that dopamine pathway. There's just way too many pathologies that arise along that pathway that you'll be doing yourself, you know, pretty decent disservice if you don't know it. So it's one of those things I would highly, highly recommend that you know for exams. So, I mean, obviously, you want to know that this whole pathway starts with phenylalanine, right? And you know that phenylalanine, right, it's converted to a tyrosine by the enzyme known as a phenylalanine hydroxylase, right? So phenylalanine hydroxylase is the enzyme that converts phenylalanine to tyrosine, right? And remember that if you have a deficiency of PAH, right, the person will have PKU. They'll have PKU. But again, the thing is, your friends at the MBME realize that everyone has memorized that, so they're beginning to reach out to other things with PKU, right? So what are the other things? The thing is, if you really think about it, phenylalanine hydroxylase uses BH4, tetrahydrobiopterin, as a cofactor. So if you have a mutation in the enzyme that regenerates that cofactor, it's known as a tetrahydrobiopterin, like BH4 reductase. Then you will also have like a phenotype of PKU, but they will have like intact, they won't have like the pH deficiency. You just have a deficiency of the cofactor. So that's something that certainly pops up on exams. You definitely want to know. And then remember, right, that tyrosine, you can use tyrosine oxidase to convert it to melanin, right? So if you have a tyrosine oxidase deficiency, obviously you'll be an albino. And remember that albinism, right, if you see albinism in the context of like low platelets and eczema, right, I'm making a wrong relationship here. If you see albinism in the context of like an immunodeficiency, I would really hope you're thinking about like Chidiya Kigashi. The other thing I was thinking about that I almost mentioned, if you see like low platelets, eczema, right, that's another skin condition, and you notice that a person has like problems with like recurring viral and fungal infections, I would want you to think about a Wiskott-Aldrich syndrome. Remember, that's an X-linked disorder, so it will not be in a girl on an MBME exam, it will be in a boy, okay? So those are two high yield things to know. And then that tyrosine, right, obviously tyrosine hydroxylase can convert the tyrosine to like DOPA. Remember that BH4, right, tetrahydrobiopterin is also the cofactor there. And then that DOPA, you can convert it to dopamine, right? You can convert the DOPA to dopamine. And the clinical relevance there is with Parkinson's drugs, right? So you've probably heard of the Parkinson's drug, carbidopa, levodopa, right? So the thing is, carbidopa is a DOPA analog. Levodopa is also a DOPA analog. But the thing is, you want that levodopa to go into the brain and be converted by an enzyme known as DOPA decarboxylase to dopamine, right? So that you want the effect in the brain, because that's where you have all the issues in Parkinson's. But problem is, there is also DOPA decarboxylase in the periphery, right? So you need to present like almost like a sacrificial drug, in this case carbidopa. So that carbidopa will be metabolized by the peripheral DOPA decarboxylase, so that levodopa can make its way into the CNS and then be converted by the CNS dopa decarboxylase into into dopamine, right? And then that can help relieve the symptoms of Parkinson's disease. Dopa decarboxylase, remember, uses vitamin B6 as a cofactor. Don't forget that vitamin B6 is a pyridoxal phosphate. Again, that's another reason why when a person is taking isoniazid, you really do need to supplement vitamin B6, right? If you don't supplement by the vitamin B6, you're putting that, you're putting that patient in a lot of trouble. And then dopamine, right? There are many things that break up metabolized dopamine. So things like catechol or methyltransferase, right? So COMT, it breaks down dopamine into like inactive stuff, right? So there are drugs like entacapone and tocapone, right? So entacapone and tocapone, they work by inhibiting COMT. And when you inhibit COMT, dopamine will persist for longer, and you can use those to treat a Parkinson's disease. Another enzyme that breaks down dopamine is monoamine oxidase B, so MAOB, right? Remember, that's inhibited by drugs like selegiline and rasagiline. So if you inhibited monoamine oxidase B, again, dopamine will persist for long, and again, dopamine will persist for long, and you can again hopefully relieve the symptoms of Parkinson's disease. And then I guess some other things to keep in mind. So dopamine, right? It can be acted on by this enzyme, dopamine beta hydroxylase, that can convert it to like norepinephrine. And then norepinephrine can be converted to epinephrine by this enzyme known as many people call it like PNMT. It's like, if I'm not mistaken, I think it's like phenyl. Come on, divine, think. I believe it's phenyl ethanolamine N-methyl transferase. Yeah, PNMT. I think that's right. So because PNMT adds, you're essentially adding a methyl group to norepinephrine to make it into epinephrine. So you need PNMT for that. And remember, you need a methyl donor, right? And the classic methyl donor is S-adenosylmethionine, right? So that, remember, when SAM gives its methyl group off, it becomes homocysteine. So you can already see again why your friends at the NBME will really, really like this pathway. Because there are many biochem concepts you can integrate here. Another thing is, you always hear that, oh, glucocorticoids have a permissive effect on the sympathetic nervous system. Well, guess what? One of the ways they have a permissive effect on the sympathetic nervous system is by activating PNMT, right? Cortisol is a direct activator of PNMT. So that's just something you want to keep at the back of your mind for tests. So again, really, this tyrosine, dopamine, whatever pathway is very high to know. You'll be doing yourself a very big disservice if you don't know that stuff as you're preparing for your USMLE Step 1 exam. And then what if they give you a question about a patient that has, like 2 days ago, they came into the hospital and they tell you that this person has, came in with nuchal rigidity and severe headache, very high fevers, and let's say it's a college student that lives in a dorm, whatever, and then they say, what's your diagnosis, right? Obviously, you know this person has meningitis. Meningitis, remember, it's vaccine preventable, right? There's a meningococcal vaccine. You're supposed to get it at the age of 12 before you start college, right? So that's a high yield thing to know for exams. Another high yield thing to know is that, what if they then give you a question and they tell you that, oh, you know, this person, was doing okay from a meningitis perspective, but then you notice one morning the patient is like profoundly hypotensive and the patient becomes like comatose, and they tell you that despite the administration of multiple pressors, this patient's blood pressure is still like 50 over 30 or some very low number. What are you thinking about under those circumstances? I would really hope you're thinking about Waterhouse-Friderichsen syndrome, right? Waterhouse-Friderichsen syndrome. Remember, when a person has Neisseria meningitis, can involve the adrenal gland, and then that can cause something called a Waterhouse-Friderichsen syndrome. And the thing is, your friends at the NBME, right, they know that every human being has memorized, oh, Neisseria meningitis, Waterhouse-Friderichsen syndrome, right? They know every human being has memorized that. So they don't really go after that anymore. They go after more like the primary adrenal insufficiency that essentially happens when a person has Waterhouse-Friderichsen syndrome, right? Because essentially it's almost like you are getting an Addison's disease style presentation, but from an infectious cause, right? So essentially they can give you like a question with a lot of arrows, and then you need to figure out what happens to things like, I don't know, like sodium, potassium, yada, 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 in the setting of Waterhouse-Friderichsen syndrome. Very high yield to know that these people's sodium will be low, right? Because again, if the adrenal gland has been destroyed by the Neisseria meningitis, right? Then you won't have glucocorticoids like cortisol. You won't have mineralocorticoids like aldosterone. So if you don't have aldosterone on board, you'll lose the ability to reabsorb sodium at the level of the principal cell of the collecting duct. So if that happens, you'll become hyponatremic. Because you are also not reabsorbing sodium at the level of the principal cell of the collecting duct, you'll also lose the ability to dump potassium in your urine. So those people will actually be hyperkalemic, right? And then if people have, because the adrenal glands, right, are not working, so you're no longer making cortisol, those people will get, if you check the levels of ACTH, the ACTH will actually be elevated, right, because there's no negative feedback from cortisol. If you wanted to say, oh, let me test these people for this primary adrenal insufficiency, if you give a person with a history of Waterhouse-Friderichsen syndrome, you give them like ACTH or like an ACTH analog, they would not have, basically their cortisol will fail to rise with ACTH augmentation, right? Telling you that, oh, this person's problem likely lies at the level of the adrenal gland. And then remember, right, these people, they will also have a metabolic acidosis, right? Because again, remember, one of the jobs of aldosterone is to increase the activity of that proton pump that is found at the alpha intercalated cell of the distal nephron. So if aldosterone is not around, that proton pump doesn't work. You don't dump protons in your urine, so you retain protons, so you develop like a metabolic acidosis with that. And that metabolic acidosis, to be honest, if you really wanted to stretch your thinking a little more, that would be a non-anion gap metabolic acidosis. And if you wanted to stretch your thinking even some more, that would be a type 4 RTA. Remember, type 4 RTAs arise in the setting of hypoaldosterone states, like what happens in the setting of primary adrenal insufficiency. Another thing they could also test, right? They could ask you for like a CBC abnormality that arises in the setting of Waterhouse-Friderichsen syndrome. Obviously, right, those people's eosinophil counts will go up. Because remember, right, glucocorticoids cause apoptosis of eosinophils. So whenever you have primary adrenal insufficiency and you're no longer able to make glucocorticoids, you will have less apoptosis of eosinophils. So your eosinophil count will rise. So you'll have signs and symptoms of, you'll essentially have hypereosinophilia detected on a CBC. Again, that's a high yield thing to know. So I think that's all I'm going to say about our Waterhouse-Friderichsen syndrome, and I think I'm going to go ahead and move on. Now, what if they give you a question about a kid, you know, that, you know, the parents notice that his head has been swelling for the last couple of months, and they tell you that this kid is at the 99th percentile for head circumference, and they tell you that this kid seems to be having like, you know, like visual difficulty, and then they tell you that they obtain imaging of the kid's brain, and they notice that they see like this calcified mass in the brain. What's your diagnosis? Well, I would really, really, really hope that you're saying that this person has a craniopharyngioma, right? Again, some pathologists call this an adamantinomatous or craniopharyngioma. But craniopharyngiomas, it's very high yield to know that those things are associated with, you want to know the embryologic origin. It's just something that your friends at the MBME, they love to test quite a bit. Those craniopharyngiomas, they derive from Rathke's pouch, right? They derive from Rathke's pouch. I guess some other weird high-yield, like, embryological buzz phrases that your friends at the MBME want you to know, right, is, for example, they can give you a question about a kid, newborn, has, like, profound respiratory difficulty at birth, and then they tell you that this kid, like, they perform imaging of the chest, and they notice that you're seeing GI folds in the thoracic cavity. If you see that, I would really hope you're thinking about, like, a diaphragmatic hernia, right? Remember the diaphragm, right? Divides your thoracic cavity from your abdominal cavity. So they may ask for the embryologic pathophysiology behind a diaphragmatic hernia. The thing you really should think about is you should think about it as problems with like the development, and I've said this in like many podcasts in the past, but again, repetition always helps. It arises from issues with the development of something called the pleuroperitoneal membrane. Again, that's the thing. Try to understand things and you won't have to memorize much, right? So how do I remember that it's pleuroperitoneal membrane? Well, think about it. Just literally look at the name. Pleuroperitoneal, right? So that means you have some kind of membrane that is separating the pleural cavity from the peritoneal cavity, which is effectively what the diaphragm does, right? So when you have problems with the development of the pleuroperitoneal membrane, then that person can have a diaphragmatic hernia because the membrane that's supposed to separate the thoracic cavity from the abdominal cavity does not exist. So those are, again, all high-yield things to keep at the back of your mind. Now, what if they give you a question about a patient that has been having a, you know, pretty, let's say it's like a patient from a developing, okay, you know, let's not use developing country. Patient from a developed country, let's say this patient went to like, on a missionary trip somewhere, and then, you know, came back with like really bad diarrhea, like really bad watery diarrhea, and they're like profoundly volume depleted, and they tell you that this person, on exam, they have like skin tinting and all that, yada, yada, yada. And then they're asking for the mechanism behind the person's diarrhea. The thing is, your friends on the MBM, at the MBME, right, they love to test mechanisms behind diarrheal diseases on tests. I don't know for whatever. Actually, it's actually a nice thing to know because it helps you group things logically so you know what you're treating. But basically, this person likely has a secretory diarrhea, right? And you, again, you should hopefully know that this person has a diarrhea from a cholera, right? Remember, the cholera toxin is essentially like an adenylate cyclase in and of itself. So it converts ATP to cyclic AMP, and that increases the secretion of chloride through the CFTR channel, right? And if you secrete more chloride, water will follow alongside and you get a secretory diarrhea with that. The thing is, literally, with the mechanisms of diarrhea, it can literally make up like maybe like 10 or 20 different MBME style questions, right? I mean, like, think about it, right? What if they give you a question about a patient that was recently started on a drug for diabetes and they have like really bad like diarrhea, right? Then you may want to think about anosmotic diarrhea. So the mechanism here will be osmosis, right? So anosmotic diarrhea, remember, there are certain drugs that are used to treat diabetes. They work by preventing the reabsorption of glucose in the GI tract. So they are brush border drugs, right? So drugs like Acarbose and Miglitol, they inhibit this brush border enzyme known as alpha glucosidase. And believe it or not, your friends at the MBME can actually ask for the location of this enzyme. You want to go ahead and pick the answer that says microvilli or says brush border, okay? So drugs like Acarbose and Miglitol, right, they inhibit alpha glucosidase. And by inhibiting alpha glucosidase, you prevent the reabsorption of glucose in the distal nephron because you're essentially preventing the breakdown of disaccharides to monosaccharides. Remember, disaccharides are not able to be reabsorbed, but monosaccharides can. So if you inhibit a disaccharidase like alpha glucosidase, so again, on your exam, instead of putting alpha glucosidase as an answer choice, they can actually put disaccharidase. If you inhibit alpha glucosidase, you don't break down disaccharides to monosaccharides, you prevent glucose reabsorption. Those agents stain the GI tract, they attract water, and then you have an osmotic diarrhea with that. I mean, another thing that can cause an osmotic diarrhea, right, they can give you a young person that, you know, has been having like a lot of like bloating and abdominal pain with and diarrhea that are coupled to like the consumption of males. You'll be like a teenager, or it can be like an Asian person or an African person. If you see that, right, you obviously want to think about a lactase deficiency, right? So this person has like a lactose intolerance that's essentially causing their symptoms. Very high yield thing to keep at the back of your mind. Now remember, right, if you have a deficiency of lactase, again, you have a deficiency of a disaccharidase. If you have a deficiency of a disaccharidase, you won't be able to break down lactose into glucose and galactose. And guess what? If you can't do that, well, you're in trouble. You won't be able to deal with lactose. And if you can't deal with lactose, then obviously you'll have issues with, you'll have malabsorption issues, right? The lactose will stay in your GI tract. It will attract fluid. You get an osmotic diarrhea with that. And remember, right, kids that have a history of essential galactosemia, remember that's when you have like a galactose 1-phosphate ureotransferase deficiency. Those kids, they cannot get breast milk, right? Because breast milk again contains lactose, right? So you don't want that. So again, just high yield things to keep at the back of your mind there. And then secretory diarrhea, right? I already talked about like cholera, right? So again, developing country, drunk from a stream, yada, 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 losing like a crap ton of fluid. Remember, if a person has cholera diarrhea, right, your treatment is to give the person something called oral rehydration therapy, right? To essentially give like a solution, like a sugar water, like a salt sugar solution, because the salt sugar solution, right, will promote the reabsorption of that glucose, right, and salt and water, right? Because when a person has cholera, right, most of the transporters in the GI tract are knocked out. But the sodium glucose linked transporter, more specifically the SGLT1 transporter, is still functional. So look at the name of the transporter, sodium glucose linked transporter, right? Sodium glucose linked transporter. So that means it's a transporter that links sodium and glucose reabsorption. So by supplying a salt sugar solution, right, you will increase the reabsorption of stuff through that SGLT1 transporter, and that will help with at least trying to maintain hydration, at least however you can, in the setting of a cholera diarrhea. Although those people also probably need, like, you know, very good IV fluids. Now, remember, right, this, they, you know, just give you like a non-specific question about a patient that, you know, traveled like out of the country. Let's say they traveled to like Mexico and they come back and they have like, you know, like a mild watery diarrhea. I would hope you're thinking about like enterotoxigenic E. coli, right? ETEC, remember, sometimes it's known as a Montezuma's Revenge. I remember ETEC, right, has two toxins, right? Like it has a heat stable toxin that activates guanylyl cyclase, and then it has like a heat labile toxin that activates adenylyl cyclase, right? So you have an increase in cyclic AMP in the presence of the heat labile toxin, and you have an increase in cyclic GMP with the stable toxin, right? The heat stable or the heat labile toxins, again, as I mentioned. So that's a big thing you want to keep in mind. Again, if you activate the adenylate cyclase, again, you have a secretory diarrhea with that. And I mean, I just mentioned a few seconds ago about the SGLT1 transporter. Well, hopefully you remember that if there is an SGLT1 transporter, well, guess what? There is also an SGLT2 transporter, right? Those SGLT2 transporters, you find them at the level of the proximal convoluted tubule. Remember that those transporters are inhibited by drugs like canagliflozin or dapagliflozin or empagliflozin, right? Those are your SGLT2 inhibitors that are used for the treatment of diabetes and mellitus, because you're essentially preventing the reabsorption of glucose at the level of the proximal convoluted tubule. Remember, that's where you actually reabsorb 100% of the glucose that gets into your urine. And then another secretory diarrhea question, right? They can, again, easily give you a question about a patient, you know, that has a history of like MEN1 syndrome. And then they tell you that this person has been having, you know, pretty bad watery diarrhea for like months and months and months. And then they give you like all these labs, and you notice that the person's chloride is like 90, right? So it's pretty, you know, like pretty low. And then they give you like the BMP, and you see that the person's potassium is like 3. Right, so the person has hypokalemia. I would really hope under those circumstances you're thinking about a VIPoma. Sometimes a VIPoma is known as WDHA syndrome, right? So that's essentially like watery diarrhea, hypokalemia, and achlorhydria. That's why they have the low chloride on labs, right? So remember that vasoactive, so VIPoma, right, it means like an OMA, so a mass that secretes VIP, vasoactive intestinal peptide. The thing is, VIP, right, the hormone, right, increases GI motility. It increases flux through the GI tract. So that can, again, cause like a secretory diarrhea, right, with a VIPoma. They can test it in the context of the MEN1 syndrome. Again, I hope that you remember that MEN1, right, has a mixture of problems with the parathyroid, right? So they can get hypercalcemia. They get pancreatic neuroendocrine tumors like VIPomas, insulinomas, gastrinoma. Remember, insulinomas will present with Whipple's triad. Gastrinomas will present in the context of the Zollinger-Ellison syndrome. Remember your glucagonomas with the necrolytic and migratory erythema, right? So those are all presentations. So like I said, MEN1, parathyroid problems, pancreatic problems, and they can also get pituitary adenomas, right? So like a prolactinoma, for example, or a growth hormone secreting a tumor. So those are all things that can present there. And please don't forget, right, that MEN1, it's inherited in an autosomal dominant fashion, right? And the mutation is in the menin gene, okay? So that's, again, a high yield thing to keep in mind. And then, so I've kind of talked about like the diarrhea that, you know, can happen from osmosis, can happen from secretion. There's others, but these are, you know, the big high yield ones. There are also those that can arise from malabsorption, right? So, like, for example, if a person is taking an orlistat, right? So if a person is taking orlistat, right, there's a drug that's used to treat, that's used to help people with weight loss. Remember, it's an inhibitor of lipase. Well, if you inhibit lipase, you'll prevent the conversion of triglycerides to monoacylglycerol and 2-free fatty acids. Well, the thing is, you cannot directly reabsorb triglycerides, right? So you're essentially causing like malabsorption in a sense, right? So that can cause a malabsorptive style diarrhea. Celiac disease, right? Same issue, right? You have like destruction, right? Like autoimmune destruction of like your brush border, right? In your GI tract, right? Those things can all cause problems with malabsorption, and you can get diarrhea with that. Although remember, celiac disease also tends to be associated with like a rash, especially on extensor surfaces. That's the thing called dermatitis herpetiformis, right? That's a high yield thing you want to keep at the back of your mind. And remember that people that have a history of celiac disease Celiac disease actually has a very nice association with like IgA deficiency. So that's something you'd want to commit to memory. Another thing you want to commit to memory with celiac disease is that they can ultimately develop something called an enteric associated T-cell lymphoma. So EATL, an enteric associated T-cell lymphoma. That is something that is not in many study resources, but it shows up quite prominently on the USMLE exams. So it's one of those things you sort of kind of want to keep at the back of your mind. And remember, right, people that have celiac disease, they tend to have antibodies against like gliadin or anti-endomysial antibodies. So ENDO-MYSIAL antibodies. And then they may also have antibodies against the tissue transglutaminase. And then remember, people that also have celiac disease, right, they tend to have like very low weight on NBMA exams. If a person has, you know, like they are overweight or obese, they can have celiac disease on an NBMA exam. That's just gamesmanship for tests. Now, another thing that can cause malabsorptive diarrhea, right? Things like tropical spur, right? And actually, I neglected, I guess, to mention this. Remember, in celiac disease, right, you obviously treat celiac disease by, you know, restricting gluten in the diet or eliminating gluten from the diet, right? Cystic fibrosis, again, is another thing that can cause a malabsorptive style diarrhea, right? Because in CF, right, remember, chromosome 7, you have problems with, you know, the CFTR transporter, right? So you are not, your intestinal contents get like gunked up. That's one. But really, what's the thing that really causes their diarrhea? The thing is, they also gunk up like their pancreatic ducts, right? So like lipase is not released. Well, if lipase is not released, it's almost like, it's essentially like you have like a genetic disease that operates like early stack. You don't have any activity of lipase because it just doesn't make its way to the GI tract. So if it doesn't make its way to the GI tract, well, you're kind of in trouble there, right? Because you have a fat malabsorption and then you run into issues. And remember that when you have fat malabsorption, right, one other thing that can happen is you can also have like night blindness from like vitamin E deficiency, or like secondary hyperparathyroidism from like vitamin D deficiency, or you can have like ataxia because your spinal cerebellar tracts don't work well, or you can also have like acanthocytosis, right, if you look at a red blood cell smear, because you have a vitamin E deficiency, or you can have bleeding because you have a vitamin K deficiency. Because the thing is, whenever you have a fat malabsorption, you're also going to have a fat soluble vitamin malabsorption. Okay, so again, those are all high yield things to keep in mind. And then there are certain GI motility disorders. So this can be like a motility cause of diarrhea, right? So if, for example, a person is taking a person has like a history of diabetes, and then they have like, you know, constipation that is alternated with diarrhea, I would really hope under those circumstances that you are thinking about a diabetic gastroparesis. That can actually be a cause of diarrhea because they essentially have like an autonomic neuropathy of their GI tracts, right? So the hyperglycemia has kind of like messed up their neurons that constitute like the plexi that we find in the GI tract. Also drugs like, think about it. Why do people get diarrhea, right? When they take a macrolide, right? So remember, macrolides can cause diarrhea. So that'll be a motility style cause of diarrhea, right? Because remember, your macrolides, drugs like erythromycin, for example, erythromycin is a motilin receptor agonist, right? So by being a motilin receptor agonist, it actually promotes GI motility. So again, those are things you want to keep in mind. If a person has, and remember that, actually, maybe sort of taking, in fact, because I know this has gone on for more than 30 minutes, so I'm going to round up probably within the next 2 minutes. But there's just two high yield integrations I want to throw in here, right? So one thing I want to maybe mention here, right? They can give you a question about a patient, you know, that has like, you know, like a history of like diabetic gastroparesis. And then they tell you that, oh, you start treating a person with metoclopramide. And then they start describing like extra pyramidal style symptoms, right? That is a very nice way your friends at the MBME can integrate GI with psych, right? So that's one thing you want to keep in mind. Like they've done this. This is like a time-honored like MBME trick. You do this all the time where they'll give you a question about a person has a history of diabetic gastroparesis. You start the patient on metoclopramide. Many people forget that metoclopramide is a dopamine receptor antagonist, right? So it can certainly cause the extra pyramidal side effects that you observe with the regular good old-fashioned antipsychotics like haloperidol. So that's something you want to keep at the back of your mind. And then the last integration I think I want to mention here, remember, chronic diarrhea can also arise in a person. This would be more of like a secretory diarrhea, but it can arise in the setting of carcinoid syndrome, right? Remember, carcinoid syndrome, you have a tumor, it's usually like in the appendix or somewhere in the small intestine, producing a crap ton of serotonin. And when you produce all that serotonin, then you can then ultimately run into trouble, right? And remember, the way you, the classic presentation of Come on, Divine, think. The classic presentation of carcinoid, right? Is like the person will have like diarrhea, they'll have like flushing, and they'll have like right-sided heart lesions. Because remember, the lungs, right, have the ability to break down serotonin. So it's only the right side of the heart that will see the effects. And usually the right-sided heart problems you get are things like tricuspid regurg and like pulmonic stenosis. There's this nice mnemonic that exists out there. It's called like TIPS. That's a way to remember the right-sided valvular pathologies that arise in the setting of carcinoid syndrome. So things like tricuspid insufficiency and pulmonic stenosis. Remember, whenever they tell you that a valve is insufficient, it's the same thing as valvular regurg. So that's something to keep at the back of your mind. And then one other thing I guess I'll go ahead and see is, remember, if a person has a history of carcinoid syndrome, right, they will also have, sorry, I know I said I'll take an extra 2 minutes. Whoops, sorry about that. Again, but I promise I'm going to be done very soon. But whenever a person has carcinoid syndrome, right, again, all these ideas as I'm speaking, just more ideas just keep dropping into my head, and they are all USMLE worthy. So sorry, I just want to, give you, I guess, the best bang for your buck with this podcast. So my apologies. If a person has carcinoid syndrome, right, remember they can also get like the, they can also get what's this condition called? Pellagra, right? Because remember, whenever you have high levels of serotonin, remember serotonin, another name for serotonin is 5-HT, right? So like 5-hydroxytryptophan. So it converts, so essentially serotonin is a derivative of tryptophan. Well, problem is tryptophan is also used to make niacin. So if you have like this weird tumor, right, that's making you like consume all your, essentially make you consume all your tryptophan to make serotonin, right, then you have less feedstock available to make niacin, and obviously that'll cause a lot of problems, right? So that's just something you want to keep in mind. So they can get like the three, actually it's more like 4 Ds of pellagra, where you have like the diarrhea, the dermatitis, the dementia, and the death. The death is, oh, I mean, obviously that's not an ideal outcome, right? So that's something you want to watch out for. Another thing that can cause like that problem, right, is if a person has like what's this thing called, like Hartnup disease, right? So Hartnup disease, you have trouble reabsorbing like neutral amino acids in at the level of the at the level of the proximal convoluted tubule, and also in the GI tract, right? So if you have those problems, right, well, you won't be able to reabsorb tryptophan. Well, if you can't reabsorb tryptophan, you have a whole new set of problems on your hands, right? So you can't, if you're not reabsorbing tryptophan, can't make niacin, and then you obviously have the 4 Ds of a pellagra. And then remember, the way you diagnose carcinoid syndrome, right, is obviously you check the person's urine and you notice that they will have elevated levels of the substance of 5-HIAA. Because remember, 5-HIAA is a derivative of serotonin, right? So the levels of 5-HIAA in your urine mirror the levels of serotonin in your body. So whenever you have carcinoid syndrome, the levels of 5-HIAA in your urine will go up. Now, one other thing I'll go ahead and mention, because the thing is, your friends at the MBME, again, people say, oh, the new USMLE exams are so hard, blah, 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 blah. They're essentially just taking, again, the things you know and just, testing in a slightly different light, right? So the thing is, your friends at the MBME, they can actually ask you, like a novel question will be, what will be true of the levels of 5-HIAA in the urine of a person that has depression? Well, if a person is depressed, if you remember the, I don't know, it's called like the, is it catecholamine hypothesis of depression, where, oh, depression is associated with low levels of serotonin, norepinephrine, and dopamine. Obviously, if a person has depression, they should have low levels of serotonin. So if they have low levels of serotonin, they should have low levels of 5-HIAA in the urine. So that's the way they can take some of the knowledge you need from carcinoid syndrome and infuse it in a psychiatry question. I mean, that's, believe it or not, that is something that your friends at the MBME, again, they've been doing over the last like 3-4 months on exams. So just something to keep at the back of your mind. So I think I'm going to go ahead and stop here. This rapid review has gone on for too long. But as I do at the end of every podcast, I do offer one-on-one tutoring for many exams. Step 1, Step 2 CK, Step 3, Step 2 CS. If you're a med student, your preclinical exams, your, if you're a third-year med student, your shelf exams. If you're a medicine resident, like the ABIM board exams, the internal medicine in training exam, I offer tutoring for all those things. And then if you have like a college buddy, that needs tutoring for like gen chem, o chem, physics, biochem, histology, physiology, I offer tutoring for all that. And then there's this thing I've been talking about recently, like longitudinal tutoring, where if you're a med student, I tutor you like your first or second year, I tutor you for all your block exams. Or if you're a third year, I tutor you for your shelf exams. But at the same time, I tutor you for your upcoming USMLE exam. Everyone I've done this with, they've been like wildly successful on their tests. So if that's something you're interested in, reach out to me. It's something that works really, really well for people. Again, I've done it with a select number of people over the last couple of months, but it has worked extremely well for those people. So if you're interested in that, just let me know. And also, there's this Booster USMLE course I also offer, where For step 2 CK and step 3, it's 10 hours. For step 1, it's 20 hours, where, again, like in that time frame, I review a lot of the high yield concepts that you'll see tested on the exam. So again, if that's something you're interested in, feel free to reach out to me. You can either reach out to me through the website, or you can send me an email at divineinterventionpodcasts@gmail.com. So have a wonderful rest of your day. I will see you in the next podcast. God bless you. Thank you.